From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans love oil. From SUVs to suburban McMansions to quarter pounders and fries by the ton, the American lifestyle is deeply, pervasively dependent on that viscous, shiny black gold. Even $2 a gallon gasoline prices this summer barely touched the appetite of the American economy for oil. But the oil-fired economy and the lifestyle that comes with it is nearing an end, says writer Paul Roberts in his new book, The End of Oil. Oil is simply going to be too scarce and too expensive to sustain Americans' carefree oil-guzzling ways. A radical adjustment will be required, says Roberts. It can happen gradually with decisive efforts to ease the shift, or it can come the hard way with massive shortages, Middle Eastern meltdown, global warming, and drastic limits on oil consumption, forcing the world into a chaotic rendezvous with the post-oil age. Tonight on Point, the end of oil and what comes next. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Paul Roberts, a regular contributor to Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, The End of Oil: On the Edge of a Perilous New World. Good evening and welcome, Paul Roberts.
Thanks, Tom.
Paul, the last couple of weeks have seemed like a curtain raiser. You've been watching this for a long time, but for a lot of people out there, these spiking gasoline prices and what we've seen about Middle Eastern oil supplies and OPEC's debate and this roaring demand from China, suddenly the whole world seems to be waking up to this vista. My gosh, there's not enough of this stuff to carry us much further on this path.
Well, it does look like, you know, we've hit something new. And really, I think most people are asking at the consumer level, policy level, you know, are these high prices here to stay? Is this a signal that the energy order is changing fundamentally, or is it, you know, another seasonal thing? And, you know, historically, Americans have gotten accustomed to oil prices rising and falling with the summer, and, you know, they forget about it in the fall. And we're gonna get a chance to see here in a couple of months whether that's going to happen again or whether we are truly onto something new here.
So what's your best guess? You've paid a lot of attention to this. Have we arrived at the watershed, or are we going to be back in another 6 months or a year to, you know, bring on the mega SUV and off we go into the sunset?
Well, it's clear to me that we're seeing the beginning of something new here. You know, it's not simply that prices are high. I mean, there's fundamental tightness in the market that isn't explained away by the war premium, isn't explained away simply by speculators driving the price up. You know, there are some fundamental issues, some tension between supply and demand. And demand side, you know, we definitely have China. We have, you know, China growing faster than anyone expected and sucking up more oil than people anticipated. The U.S. economy is coming roaring back, and that means a big uptick in demand. India is on the horizon. We've got 100 million middle-class consumers who are waiting to start consuming Western style, and when they do, it's going to be a big pinch on oil. So these are near-term issues, and, you know, and then we have kind of longer-term, we have this sense that, you know, compelling more evidence that we're just not finding oil as fast as we used to. You know, it's clear discovery rates are falling. You know, for like the last century, we've been able to find more oil every year on average. And about 1961, it changes. We start, at that point, finding less oil each year on average. And, you know, right now we burn about 29 billion barrels of oil a year. That's in our cars and our furnaces and our factories. Mm-hmm. And we're finding about 9 billion barrels of oil a year. It's, you know, so the ratio is 3 burned, 1 found. You know, you can't run a machine on a ratio like that for long.
Paul Roberts, put an X-ray on the American economy and lifestyle for a moment and its dependence on oil. You mentioned cars and furnaces and factories right there, and those make sense. We think about filling up the gas tank. We know what it costs to heat the home. We know how factories run. But you point out in your new book, The End of Oil, that really oil underlies much more than just those frontline gas burners and oil burners and all the rest.
Well, oil was really critical to the kind of economic growth we've had for the last century. You know, oil supported factories, you know, it fueled ships, but mainly it fueled, you know, cars, buses, trucks, the transportation element of our economy. And this allowed us to grow fast, allowed us to, you know, companies to respond quickly to new markets. You know, you could deliver things fast. It was this kind of fast-paced, just-in-time, you know, economy that we're really proud of and has been real efficient and has created wealth, you know, like nobody's business, but it really shows how vulnerable we are to anything that threatens that transportation sector. And since transportation is fueled 90% by oil or oil fuels, you know, anything that threatens oil threatens our entire economy.
And with that, lifestyle things as well, you point to the agriculture industry and its dependence on petrochemicals, to the construction industry and its dependence on petrochemicals, right on down the line.
Yeah, it's really the whole thing. And what's interesting is that if you look at the amount that the average household spends on gasoline or heating fuel, it's not that much. I mean, certainly people on fixed income get hammered, but most of Americans, you know, are wealthy enough that if you'd pencil it out, it's not that big a deal. And this is why consumers, on the one hand, they'll bitch about high gasoline prices. In fact, you just turn on the news every night and you will hear another segment of yet still more people complaining.
Above $2 for the first time in history and nobody's happy about it.
Right. But the fact of the matter is that in terms of changing behavior, consumers, they're doing a little calculation in their head. You know, it's like, how much is this really hurting me? And the threshold really is when a consumer says at some level, hey, this is for real. You know, because most, like we were talking earlier, most consumers think it's seasonal. They think it's going to go away. They'll suffer a few months of pain because they know that soon prices will drop. As soon as consumers make that decision that this may be in there for a long time, they start making decisions about purchases. So, for example, you're not going to, you know, if you're thinking about replacing your car, you're probably not going to go out and buy a Hummer. You know, if you're thinking about moving to a new house, you might think seriously about moving to one that's closer to work, that lets you get, you know, use mass transit. And these are the kinds of decisions that actually have a huge impact on overall consumption. But they're the kinds of decisions consumers won't make, or at least make differently, until they believe that we're in this for the long haul.
So do you think that perception is dawning now? Is this the change, or is the American consumer just stubbornly resistant when it comes to changing this lifestyle, these patterns? How much will it take to twist the arm and make things change?
I think this realization is dawning at the margins. I mean, you see, Hummer sales, you know, to use the most egregious example, have finally tanked, or at least they've softened, to use the industry term. And we see the larger SUVs, sales are flat. And, you know, the auto industry analysts believe that you have to wait a couple months to see if this is an actual trend or if it's just an anomaly. But I think that, you know, at the margins, people are realizing that it's not just a hobby anymore. You know, driving is actually part of, you know, some activity that has a serious impact on their pocketbooks and on the economy generally. I think there's a lot of, you know, status, kind of negative status that's now accruing to people that own large cars. You know, it used to be in the 90s, we'd won the first Gulf War. The energy crisis was over. The economy was booming. These big kind of militaristic vehicles were in fashion.
Let's party.
And it was a status symbol. I mean, you had Arnold Schwarzenegger making the Hummer, you know, turning it from a military vehicle into a kind of a paramilitary civilian vehicle. And I think it was a status symbol. It was a symbol of American might, I guess, and cultural, isolation and insulation. And I think now, you know, the Hummer drivers and drivers of big SUVs are getting tired of being flipped off, of just getting that look, you know. And they might not have altered their behavior based simply on how much it was costing them, but I think they're getting tired of getting that look. And I think that's kind of where it starts.
Let's talk about supply. You write that the extraordinary machine we have built to supply that demand you just described cannot sustain itself in its present form. But you say that new discoveries of oil will not compensate for depletion by this oil-hungry world led by the U.S. and, as you say, with China and India right behind. What does the future glide path look like? We've heard these warnings for years, but where's the cliff out there? Or maybe we're there now.
Well, it's true. Over the past century, about every 10 years, you'll hear a pessimist say we're going to run out of oil in 10 years. And each time in the past, the oil industry has gone out and, usually encouraged by high oil prices, and it's found more oil, it's developed really sophisticated technology and has become much better at finding oil and extracting it and refining it. And yet, you know, right now we're running into some brick walls, geologically speaking. And one of those is the one we talked about earlier, which is declining discovery rates. I mean, for all that the oil industry is more sophisticated in looking for oil, it's finding less. And so it's clear that, you know, it's clear that we're running out of the oil that's easy to get to. And there's a lot more oil out there. There's oil that's harder to extract or a little harder to refine and will cost a little more. You know, but that's going to require a higher price. And there's a great deal of oil in OPEC, in OPEC countries, in the Middle East particularly. But that is also going to require a higher price. And so we're ending. I think we're coming to the end of what you might call the era of cheap oil, and that will bring all sorts of, you know, fundamental changes to the economy and, with luck, to global energy policy.
What about that policy? When you look at the U.S. government and global corporations that have a lot to do with setting policy on oil, given what you're describing here, and a lot of it has been talked about for a long time, you put it compellingly in a new case, but this isn't exactly a giant headline. We all knew that oil was and is in limited supply on this earth. What are the policy levers that are or are not being used here to respond to this? How do you interpret the way the United States is responding or not responding?
Well, again, I think it's a question reaching that threshold where enough or a majority of consumers and policymakers and CEOs start thinking that energy prices are here to stay or high energy prices are. You know, in the 70s and early 80s when we had the Arab oil embargo and the Iran-Iraq war and the price spikes, you know, the economy responded beautifully. And we like to look back at that time and say, well, it was kind of this patriotic kind of energy conservation movement, and it was led by, you know, fuel efficiency standards for cars, and consumers got into it. You know, they put their backs into it. And that's true, but you have to remember that price drove everything. We wouldn't have behaved in such a patriotic fashion had it not been for the fact that oil prices had all quadrupled over the course of a decade. And that's proven by the fact that as soon as prices began to fall during the 80s, we went right back to our old consumption habits. So really, price is what's driving this. And right now the question is, when will the current prices start really driving people to think, you know, this is for real? And this is where it's important to realize that in inflation-adjusted dollars, we're kind of at a low spike. You know,
this is not as bad as it looks. So Paul Roberts, are you saying then, don't blame government policy, don't blame the oil companies, it's all about the consumer, nothing but the gas pump price and the consumer's attitude toward that is going to drive change here ultimately?
Yeah, as Pogo says, the enemy is us. No, I mean, that's certainly part of it. You can't forget the consumer's complicity here, but you really have to look at the top. You know, American oil policy, American energy policy generally has historically been focused on supply. That is, we're gonna guarantee energy security by making sure we have access to all the supply we need and ever larger supply each year. And so that in oil has meant, you know, increased production at home, and abroad it has meant friendlier alliances with oil producers in the Middle East and elsewhere. And the Bush administration really took that policy, which was an American policy, Democrat and Republican alike, and expanded it and said, you know, and it was very explicit and articulated a case. It said, America for too long has not pumped up supply, and we're going to change that. We're coming into office. We're going to drill more wells, build more refineries. We're going to build more power plants because it's not just oil. And overseas, we're going to diversify our portfolio of foreign providers. So we're not just going to rely on the Middle East. We're going to rely on Russia. Our new ally is Russia. We're going to rely on African nations and the Caspian. And we're going to encourage oil companies to invest. And we're going to encourage these countries to open up their oil economies and let us invest. And this isn't something they invented. The Clinton administration was pushing this really hard. But the Bush administration was very outspoken, and they were articulate in making that case. And it made a lot of sense. It has a logic to it because they were going to grow the economy. Growing economies need a growing supply of energy. Therefore, we're going to go out and get it for you.
So it would seem that just hurdles us toward the cliff. But what are the implications? Is it something else? Maybe this is the right thing to do. Use it now, and it will just speed interest in alternative fuels.
Well, that's part of, you know, they have half of that equation there that they talked about. They were explicitly dismissive of conservation. They said, we're not going to conserve our way out of an energy crisis, you know. And although they tipped their hat to alternative technologies, they said at some point they may be viable. But right now the name of the game is oil and natural gas. And there's truth to that. But it meant that they were essentially not going to get behind developing these fuels, these alternative technologies and fuels. And I think what we're seeing now is that they made the wrong bet. You know, clearly you can't increase domestic production of oil in the United States more than an insignificant amount, because this country looks like a pincushion. We have been over and over this territory. We know where the oil is, and more important, we know where it isn't. And so really what they were saying all along was it was going to be about relationships with foreign suppliers. And here we come up to, you know, the Bush administration's claim that they would be able to use their special relationship with the Saudis and with other Arab governments and make sure that oil supply was kept, you know, flowing, that prices were kept moderate. And that hasn't been the case. They have not been able to deliver on that promise.
Paul Roberts, stand by. Paul Roberts is author of the new book, The End of Oil: On the Edge of a Perilous New World. Just last week, an attack on Iraq's northern oil export network, the fiercest to date, halted major exports from that country. We're looking at oil policy tonight, looking at ways ahead, ways out of the oil crunch. We spoke with Paul Roberts earlier this summer and won't be taking calls this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Paul Roberts, author of the new book, The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. Paul Roberts, you were saying that the Bush administration's energy policy essentially, given that the United States has been drilled and drilled and drilled, essentially meant turning out to the world, turning out to foreign sources of oil and turning out aggressively. How do you see the war in Iraq in those terms? There's been a big debate over whether this is a fundamentally an oil war or a political war or a hegemon's war, a freedom war. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, let's be clear that, you know, America clearly has an interest in making sure that anyone doesn't have, you know, ready access to weapons of mass destruction, is not supporting terrorism, and all the things the Bush administration claimed to be going into Iraq for.
Those are real interests, you're saying.
Yeah, but let's also be clear that, you know, the Bush administration's interest, just like, you know, any president's interest in the Middle East, has to do primarily with that region's possession of most of the world's oil. You know, we cannot... You know, this country uses more oil than any other country. It has to import more than half of that oil. And although we get a lot of our oil from neighbors like Canada and Mexico, which are pretty stable and relatively friendly, almost all our trading partners rely on the Middle East. So it's critical to our economy that the Middle East remain a stable and reliable supplier. And anything that threatens that stability and reliability is a threat to our energy security. And Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction is a threat to that stability. I mean, Dick Cheney said it himself. As recently as August of 2002, he was saying that the White House is one of their main concerns about him having weapons of mass destruction was that he would threaten the stability of an oil-important region. You know, there you have the conflation of these two concerns, oil and weapons of mass destruction.
But you've added a new twist to that in your book. You describe it almost as the United States racing to position itself powerfully on top of these oil supplies before other hungry consumers of oil could get there, before China, before India, before Europe.
That's right. I think the United States has looked into the future, and what it's seen is that, you know, it's going to be the U.S. and China that are going to be competing for resources, and we don't know in what arenas it will compete, how it will compete, but we know there will be competition, and we know that oil will certainly be one of the resources we're competing for. And finally, we know that the Middle East is the place where most of that oil lies. Now, there is a great deal of oil elsewhere in Africa and in the Caspian and in Russia, and you can see the U.S. positioning itself in Africa and in the Caspian with military bases, with diplomatic missions, with places where they can have these rapid deployment forces ready. And ostensibly, this is about combating terrorism, but it also coincides with oil resources. The U.S. is getting ready to be in a competition for oil, because the U.S. knows that no matter how quickly we move to alternatives, the importance of oil will remain important for quite some time.
Paul, in your book, you describe a meeting in 2002 between U.S. experts on energy and international relations and intelligence officials. It was called The Geopolitics of Energy in 2015. Mm-hmm. You were at that session, and the discussions revolved around four scenarios, mapping out four different pathways to a new energy economy. Can you walk us through those scenarios?
Sure. And just to be honest, I talked to people who were at the session, so I had to rely on their reports. But essentially, we had four scenarios. And they were kind of two positive and two negative. And in the two positive, we were looking at the development of technologies that allowed people to kind of shift gracefully to a post-oil economy, or at least begin reducing demand, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and reducing the reliance of countries like the U.S. and Europe and Asia on places, volatile places like the Middle East. But those were the happy scenarios. Those were the ones where the uncertainties were, how quickly can we bring on these technologies? What kinds will they be? But the overall sense was that we will have some sort of a technological fix. The negative scenarios that these intelligence experts were looking at were, suppose you have some massive climate-related disaster, you know, that forces policymakers to move quickly in dealing with fossil fuel. Let's say, for example, that we had another case where, say, 10,000 to 15,000 people in Europe die in a heat wave. Now, there's no way to prove that that heat wave is the direct result of a changing climate, but it will be very difficult to sell that to Europeans who lost relatives. And there will clearly be a clamoring, and policymakers will have to respond. And since climate is most directly affected by how we use fossil fuels, one could imagine a situation where policymakers had to move quickly about doing something about coal or fuel consumption, and maybe putting a higher tax on it and sending ripples to the economy that way.
So an emergency situation with emergency steps. Some people are already arguing for a higher tax on energy. Just in the last few days, Greg Easterbrook, Tom Friedman, just today in the New York mm-hmm. Times, John Kerry, Democratic challenger mm-hmm. for the White House, all calling for higher taxes on gasoline. What, in an emergency situation, what's the problem with higher taxes? People are calling for it already.
Well, I mean, sure, and we've talked about that kind of as a way to approach it for a long time. You know, the thing about higher taxes is how high do you have to put them before they start affecting behavior? I mean, compare Europe and the U.S. Europe, you're paying as much as the equivalent of $5 for a gallon of gasoline, and it has affected behavior, clearly. Would a U.S. support, you know, would the U.S. economy, would U.S. consumers support a tax anywhere close to that? I mean, consider the political heat that Kerry took for simply having supported a 50-cent a gallon gas tax 10 years ago.
The Bush administration has been very recently very critical of that.
That's right. Even though Cheney himself pushed for a 25-cent a gallon gas tax, the point being that Americans are very sensitive to even talking about tax. Clinton tried to push a 4-cent a gallon energy tax in 1994 and got hammered. And I think that, you know, the only time we ever talk about gas taxes is when gas prices are already high, because that's when we're in the middle of a crisis, so we know we need a new policy. So the policy says get a gasoline tax, but that's the last time you want to talk to consumers or voters about raising their gas prices.
But people have talked about it. Greg Mankiw, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, himself pushed for it. He said, mm-hmm. Put the tax on gasoline, subtract it from income tax, the effect on energy consumption mm-hmm. and the economy will be good. There are people saying we should have done it 10 years ago. We'd be in a better mm-hmm. position now. But the case you're making here in this 2015 scenario, or that you've observed here, is that if it has to be done on an emergency basis, this adjustment, the consequences could be so dire that they would be catastrophic, not just for the climate you describe, but for the economy, the U.S. economy, the global economy.
Yeah, if we have to make a sudden adjustment, you know, if, for example, let's imagine that Saudi Arabia has a civil war and it takes off, you know, about 9 million barrels of exports a day. I mean, that would just kill the oil economy and it would send prices to the roof and it would be a disaster in so many different levels and we'd have recession. And I think even worse, or as worse, you'd have countries like the U.S. and Europe and China scrambling to replace the oil they'd lost, and they would reach for whatever they could find. And leaving aside the possibility that you'd have actual conflict over oil supplies, you would clearly, unquestionably have countries like the U.S. saying, well, what kind of oil can we develop quickly? And they would look at places like Canada, which has got, you know, tons and tons of these tar sands, which are oil in a really kind of a tarry form. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the Canadians estimate they've got like a trillion barrels of oil in equivalent up there waiting to be refined. And you can turn the stuff into oil, usable oil, and you can do it cost effectively. So it's there and they're doing it. They're refining it. The problem with the tar sands is you need a huge amount of water, which is a constrained resource and is going to become more so. You need a lot of energy, which is a constrained resource. And it produces a huge amount of carbon dioxide. So, you know, Canada's already had to exempt its tar sand refining operations in order to still go forward with its Kyoto obligations.
Otherwise, because it's doubling up on the environmental damage, you say, when you go that way.
That's right. And although I have a lot of problems with Kyoto, I mean, it's deeply flawed. You need some sort of a climate policy. And yet Canada is kind of demonstrating here that you have to do one or the other. Mm-hmm. You can either support a climate policy or you can pump up your production of these tar sands. You're going to find that kind of choice in a lot of this remaining oil. You know, there's going to be an environmental cost, particularly if you have to refine it. There's really heavy oil. It's called heavy oil. It's thick molasses-like oil in Venezuela. It's the same thing. You can refine it. It's environmentally costly. These are the kind of constraints that weren't there a century ago. If you found the oil and you could get it out of the ground and refine it, you could use it.
But now if we stay on that path, now you're saying there's potential military cost, there's economic cost, there's environmental cost. So what is the way off this path? What is the technology fix? How close is the world? How feasible is it as a alternative base for the global economy, and when?
Well, the first thing is, you know, the energy market can take care of itself, you know, and it has over the past. It's moved from one fuel to another when it became economically expedient to do so. You know, we moved from coal to oil not because we ran out of coal, but because oil was had economic benefits.
Oil was easier than coal,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So that doesn't seem an exact parallel.
Well, except that there were economic benefits. And as soon as as soon as the price of oil goes up, it ceases to be economically attractive. And that's when we start looking. And the market starts looking in its magical way for alternatives. And so ideally, we'd have the market do this for us. And that's certainly what a lot of conservative economists and policymakers would want to see, because market solutions tend to be the ones that stick. They tend to be the ones that consumers and businesses like. So you have that possibility, that philosophy there. The problem with the current situation is it's a matter of timing. Is the market going to get there fast enough? Is it going to produce these alternative technologies and alternative fuels fast enough to meet other obligations? It's not simply a matter of economic obligations. It's environmental obligations. It's political obligations. And by that, I mean, are we going to have enough non-oil, you know, enough alternative fuels and technologies so that to wean ourselves from dependence on a volatile Middle East, a Middle East that could collapse in chaos at any moment? Are we going to be able to do that quickly? Who's going to get there first? Are we going to be able to have a hydrogen economy, or is Saudi Arabia going to collapse first? The same thing you could ask about the environment. Are we going to have renewable, clean fuels that don't emit carbon dioxide soon enough to abate or at least slow climate change, or are we going to fry ourselves? These are the limits that the economy has not had to contend with, the marketplace has not had to contend with in previous transitions from one fuel to another. And that is why you definitely need a policy. You need a policy that sees where we want to be and begins pushing the economy, nudging it, giving it the hints that it needs. In this case, you really have to go to a carbon tax. You need to make carbon expensive.
A carbon tax, meaning?
Meaning you have to address, you have to recognize that the oil economy, the oil-based economy, has been a freebie in many respects, in the sense that we've been able to emit carbon dioxide into the atmosphere without having to pay for it for centuries. That's one of the reasons oil is so cheap. We haven't had to pay for that external cost.
Mm-hmm.
A carbon regime recognizes that the energy system we have, the oil-based energy system we have, has this huge environmental atmospheric cost, this climate cost that we're not paying now. We're going to pay for it in 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years when climate impact begins to show its true effects. Right now, we're not, so it's easy to avoid even thinking about it. Policymakers have to think about it. They have to start thinking, well, how do we begin tweaking this economy, this marketplace, so that it begins addressing the cost of carbon? And one way is you just say, look, carbon's going to cost money. We're not going to start tomorrow. We're going to give you a 10-year grace period to kind of get your technology in order, and we're going to start out with a cheap tax, maybe a $20 a ton of carbon emitted.
On
coal, on natural gas, on gasoline,
okay.
Anything that emits carbon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that you'd pay it at the pump. If you're a utility that burns coal to make electricity, you'd pay it there. And what happens eventually is that carbon becomes so expensive to emit that utilities, say a coal-fired power plant, is faced with the choice. Do I go ahead and emit that ton of carbon dioxide and pay the fine? Or do I use the money that I was going to pay, you know, this fine with, and instead buy technology that lets me burn coal cleanly?
But you're saying to make that choice, to bring companies and consumers to that choice, is going to require policy intervention. We see that confirmed just this week. Top foreign policy advisor to Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah says, for us, that is the Saudis, the objective is to assure that oil remains an economically competitive source of energy for the long term. Their interest is absolutely contrary to this. You're saying you need a kind of government intervention because the markets aren't going to give us a smooth runway here without them.
No. In fact, the Saudis have a university that most of the research is based on looking at alternative fuels and technologies, not because they want to use them or market them, because they want to gauge the threat that these new technologies pose to an oil-based economy. I mean, they look at it as closely as the CIA used to look at the Kremlin, because it's really the looming threat for them. What the U.S. has to recognize here is that, you know, we have a carbon problem. We're not talking about it. Europe is talking about it, but we're not. And that's just delaying action. It's delaying, you know, people kind of bucking up and saying, all right, we got to do something differently. Before you even get to this, though, you have to start talking about it. And America has an energy problem. It's like Victorians and sex. You know, we don't want to talk about energy because it seems to open up a huge can of worms about consumption and just the American lifestyle generally, which no one would rather get into.
You call Americans energy prudes on that front.
That's right. We are energy prudes. And you know, SUVs are a great example. I mean, you couldn't drive a car like that unless you weren't letting yourself think about all the implications.
Let me ask you a question then. Is there a technology out there that's feasible within the time frame that oil supplies and economics allow, that the economy can shift to without a major depression, a catastrophic collapse, even that the economy can shift to and keep the American lifestyle intact? Or is the lifestyle doomed to go with the oil?
Boy, you know, I'm going to go ahead just today and say that I think it's possible. I'm feeling optimistic today. I don't know exactly why, but, you know, what it has to be is it has to be a combination of price pressure, which is happening right now. You know, so you get the market forces already going. You get people primed for something new. For example, hybrids. These hybrid gas electric cars are catching on in part because the technology is marvelous, but also because prices are making people think about it. It's not necessarily just a niche for hippies and movie stars. It may be something you and I can use. And on top of that, you need the government to start saying, look, you know, okay, it's not time to panic yet, but it is an election year after all. But it is time to think about energy and to recognize that the way we have been going about energy for the last 100 years, great as it was, you know, American as it was, is reaching kind of the end of its run. And we have to start thinking about new ways of producing energy and new ways of using it. It isn't necessarily a sacrifice proposition, because, you know, and Kerry's made this point, the U.S. could be making a lot of money, producing a lot of jobs and tax base by being a leader in these new technologies. I mean, consider for the fact that, you know, for a moment, the U.S. used to own the wind power market, and now the Europeans have taken us on that one. We used to dominate in solar power. Now the Japanese own that. And look what's happening in hybrid technologies. You know, right now it's Toyota and Honda. Now Ford has just announced that it's going to be rolling out a SUV hybrid, and that's great news. But some of the important core hybrid technology is coming from Toyota. So we're kind of outsourcing again. And the problem here is that this is something America needs to lead on, not simply because it's setting an example, not simply because, you know, we're the biggest energy user and therefore should be the cleanest energy user. It's because this is going to be the market of the future. You know, we need to be not just kind of recognizing the reality that we have to start buying this stuff. We need to start making it. I mean, you know, anywhere in the West, you can drive around and you can see Western U.S. Yeah. Increasingly, you can see wind farms, California, Oregon, Washington, in the Midwest. And that's it's a positive sign. I mean, people are showing the economics are almost there, and it's viable, you know. The problem is if you go get close to those machines and look at them, they're all from Denmark, you know. And the Europeans are really proud of their wind industry because it's providing thousands of jobs and a tax base. And that's something America needs to be part of.
Can it do it? Can it shift?
Oh, sure. It can. There's an economy there. There's a market there. There are profits to be made. We just need to get a message from the top.
Well, we're waiting for that message. Paul Roberts, thanks for joining us tonight. Thanks for the new book.
Great to be here, and thanks a lot.
Paul Roberts, author of The End of Oil, On the Edge of a Perilous New World. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. After the break, a conversation with former New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief James Bennett about Ariel Sharon and the future of Israel. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last month, I spoke with correspondent James Bennett, who had recently completed a 3-year stint as Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. His long last piece from Jerusalem, which appeared in the August 15th issue of the New York Times Magazine, grew out of an interview with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. It offered a profoundly mixed and troubling assessment of the Sharon legacy and Israel's future. James Bennett, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
You were in Israel for an extraordinary 3 years. You went in September in 2001. You were there for the Second Intifada. You've been generous with your time and thoughts with this show throughout that time. And we were really eager to read your final observations on Israel. I have a feeling one way or another we'll be reading more. But let me just go to your ultimate conclusion in this long piece yesterday and ask you to draw the route back to your experience. You described the potential legacy of Ariel Sharon as being, and I'm quoting, an Israel that is increasingly religious, walled off from its neighbors, simultaneously yearning after and fearing a Western community of nations that sees it as more and more foreign. And you put that legacy right at the feet of Ariel Sharon. Fill in the connecting tissue for us there, James Bennett.
Well, it took me 8,000 words to do that in the actual story.
Yes,
but the essence of it is Ariel Sharon's determination, really, that Israel always has to keep its fate in its own hands, that it must retain the initiative. With the Palestinian leadership in total disarray, with the Bush administration having put its own peace plan, the roadmap, essentially on the shelf, Ariel Sharon is really the only thing that's moving there, and he's trying to impose or lead the Israeli people to accept his version of what Israel's boundaries should be. And he's doing it in a unilateral basis, that is, without negotiating with the Palestinians. They wouldn't be likely to agree in a negotiation to the kind of boundaries he's seeking to draw. And so as a result, he's trying to do it unilaterally.
Let's pick apart the pieces here and see how you draw them back to Ariel Sharon. Number one, an Israel that is increasingly religious, how do you see that as a Sharon legacy?
Well, it's one of the effects of what's happening now. I don't think I say in the piece that that's specifically his doing, but it is one of the changes that's occurring in Israel under his watch. He has taken advantage of, certainly, a lot of the religious zeal of some of the immigrants in dispatching them as settlers into the occupied territories, into the West Bank and Gaza. So he's, in a sense, exploited and taken advantage of it, but I don't think he's responsible for the state's religious character. He's not a religious man himself.
But the settlement movement may be feeding into that. Walled
now, yeah, and it reinforces itself.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, Sharon very much sees himself as the sort of original secular Zionist settlement movement. But in the 70s and 80s, that movement was fading out, and he saw religious Jews, ultra-Orthodox Jews, extremely Orthodox Jews who saw the West Bank and Gaza as part of Israel's biblical heritage and had a religious reason for moving there. He saw them as really the new backbone of the settlement movement.
But now, of course, the wall, the fence, the barrier, and you describe them as Israel as literally walled off from its neighbors. You quote an advisor to Ariel Sharon saying, "What we really want is to turn our backs on the Arabs and never deal with them again. We don't want to be accepted into the Middle East anymore." And you describe a turn to the West, but a West that is ambivalent about accepting this fiercer Sharon Israel.
Yeah. That advisor was summing up what he saw as the prevailing Israeli view,
mm-hmm.
not just his own view, although it is his own view, but also what he thinks most of the public feels now. Not only after this conflict, which is now in its fourth year, but also because the peace with Egypt has never turned into the kind of warm peace that Israelis dreamed of, that the peace with Jordan hasn't really turned into that kind of peace either. They still don't feel accepted in the region. And as a result, there's this kind of collective turning of the back. And that's where a lot of support for these unilateral measures comes from.
But the warning flare you put up there is that somehow you're seeing Sharon policy as making Israel less welcomed as it faces West as well.
Well, we're seeing Israel is obviously coming under increasing criticism, I think, in the West. It's coming under new pressure from the International Court in The Hague, ruled against it on the path of the barrier that it's building in the West Bank. Many Israelis, certainly Ariel Sharon, saw that as purely anti-Semitic. They wondered why the court chose to single out this particular issue to devote so much attention to when there are numerous violations of rights that it doesn't necessarily deal with. But because they're getting so much attention there and in the United Nations, criticism in Europe is on the rise. Israelis are extremely sensitive to that and I think are feeling increasingly isolated.
You spent time with Ariel Sharon and in particular at his farm or ranch in Israel in this interview. And I'm supposing this was given as a courtesy to the New York Times bureau chief as he headed out. How did you find his state of mind, his outlook on the world and his country and neighbors after the Second Intifada and the wall going up and all the rest?
I should say it really wasn't any kind of valedictory interview. It was something I'd been trying to get for months, and it just happened to come through coincidentally then. As some Israelis say, Sharon is Sharon. He's a man whose thought very, very deeply about the issues that most concern him for decades now. He came to conclusions a long time ago about what Israel needed to do to protect itself. He has modified his thinking to some degree over time. But he's a man very, very secure in his own judgment. He's willing to take tremendous political risks and personal risks, I think, to see that judgment through. And in some, what we're seeing now in Israel, disagree with it, if you will, is a real exercise in leadership. I mean, he is trying to take the country in the direction that he feels it needs to go. He's taking substantial risks to do that.
Of course, a major element of that, the withdrawal from Gaza. How do you interpret what he's really all about there? Of course, he was a major proponent of settlement for many years.
Well, in fact, he helped design the original so-called five-finger architecture of the settlements in Gaza to break apart the Palestinian population there. There are now about 7,500 Israeli settlers in Gaza. There are about 1.3 million Palestinians that live there. It's become a kind of running sore for Israelis. A strong majority of Israelis favors getting out of Gaza. Sharon has been a politician now longer than he was a general, and he recognizes that political reality. There's also the demographic problem that many Israelis are increasingly worried about, and even Sharon has begun paying some attention to. That is this argument that within a certain number of years, given the demographic trends, there's going to be a majority of Arabs as opposed to Jews between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, that is, in Israel and its occupied territories. At that point, the argument goes Israel will have to give up either being a democracy or give up its Jewish identity. I happen to think it's much more complicated than that, but it's actually having real political consequences, the fear of this. Withdrawing from Gaza, part of the hope there is that Israel will be seen in the eyes of the world as no longer having any responsibility for these 1.3 million Palestinians. That'll postpone the demographic threat. It'll also ease substantially, potentially, the military burden on Israel.
You describe a kind of toughening that's gone on in Israel. You say Ariel Sharon's story has become Israel's story and today's Israel. And you write poignantly of there in his farmhouse, you know, lots of personal things around, but two that caught your eye. One, little statuettes of, as I recall, of dancing figures, and the other, a sketch of kind of sorrowful or tired Israeli soldiers on patrol. And you describe the sort of needle of Israeli life moving away from that the dancers and toward the patrol, and not just at a literal level, but at some very deep level. What are you getting at there?
Israel is pulled between many, many different poles, I guess you could say. The dream of many Israelis is that their country will simply be like another country, as welcomed as any other country, and that it what it will be known for in the world is its contribution to the arts, to the sciences, more for really the life in Tel Aviv than the political issues, than the powerful military, the nuclear weapons, and the constant bickering over territory and Jerusalem. These days, Israelis are obviously much more known for the latter than the former, and the country is much more preoccupied with those sorts of things. Life goes on. Israel continues to produce, obviously, great musicians, athletes, dancers, etc. But military service, including the reserve duty that Israelis have to do into their mid-40s, continues to dominate a lot of their lives. And this fear, the fear that goes with being this tiny Jewish nation on the edge of the Middle East, that fear is enduring as well.
You write that obligation, the commitment, the atmosphere of military readiness that Israelis have felt forced to adopt, but though cuts down on their access to that more creative vision, more normal vision. And you suggest that it conflicts with one of Ariel Sharon's primary future goals, which is sizable immigration to Israel, where he has pretty large vision.
It's a problem. People do continue to immigrate to Israel, but not nearly in the numbers that Sharon speaks of. He hopes to bring in another million Jews to Israel over the next 15 years or so. And at the rate they're going now, that's simply not going to happen. It's a problem. It's partly maybe because of our media coverage of the place. We often get complaints that we don't write enough about the other kind of life that one can have there. Mm-hmm. The problem with the official statements made by Israel, which tend to emphasize their feeling that they're victims, that they're subject to these atrocious attacks. It's not, you don't go to the Foreign Ministry website and see an appeal to come stroll our sandy beaches. What you see is a list of victims of terror. And also there's simply the underlying reality. The Israeli economy continues to struggle under the burden of the conflict, and it's simply not an attractive place to move right now.
You write about a deeper trend, maybe related to that, that Ariel Sharon has been concerned with for decades, ever since he made an early visit to the UK in the 1950s, as I recall, feeling that Jews in the United Kingdom just couldn't understand the Israeli experience, wanting to bond Jews around the world with the Israeli mission and worldview. Now you quote one of his close advisors saying that Israelis and Jews around the world, to quote this Sharon advisor, he says, we're moving from being brothers to being cousins, and in the next generation we will be distant cousins with some sense of shared history. Is that Sharon's view as well?
No, I don't. I think that Sharon continues to believe that Israel, he continues to believe Israel is a worldwide project. I'm not sure, and this is something people about him say, people near him who followed him closely say, is that he doesn't really understand Jews in the diaspora as well, certainly, as he understands Israeli Jews. The point that advisor was making is that a distinct Israeli identity has emerged. Israelis have a clear national identity, and it's different. It's its own thing. That's something to be proud of. But it can be somewhat alienating to Americans, to Europeans. It's where Sharon likes to think of Jews worldwide as essentially a unified group, although he recognizes that obviously people don't think alike. But what he was very concerned about as early as the 50s is that either the world would make a distinction between Israeli Jews and other types of Jews, or the Jews themselves would make this distinction. And that if that distinction existed, Israel would sort of go off on its own. It would no longer be a worldwide Jewish project. I think, in fact, that is what's starting to happen now, and that's what that advisor was talking about.
That must be a source of pretty significant consternation.
It's a source of worry to a lot of Israelis. It's a long-term trend. I mean, it's something it's hard to gauge. There still are plenty of American missions coming over to Israel, particularly now that things have gotten a lot quieter. There still are Europeans coming there on vacation. It's not like this is happening overnight. But long-term, it's something that does preoccupy a lot of thinkers in Israel.
James Bennett, Israel and you have just made it through a difficult patch of years there. We thank you for your reporting from there and for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
James Bennett, he was New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem from September 2001 until July this year. He spoke with me from a summer house on the coast of Maine, looking back on his time in Israel. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.